The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
They're doing this because they can't maneuver on the battlefield. They're being destroyed. And so in Hedgehog 2025, a NATO exercise that takes place, they look at, they use the Ukrainians as the op four, and against the NATO combined exercise. And so in a typical large maneuver exercise we think about, you kind of go into the assembly area and then you kind of unroll out of the assembly area into combat formations and you do the thing. Ukrainians destroyed them in the assembly area before they had a chance to deploy in combat formation. And one of the lessons learned from that was we've got to do things differently.
Aloha and welcome to Strategic Voices. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 6, Changing Character of War. Has technology changed how wars are won? For much of the post-Cold War era, military planners assumed that advances in technology would make warfare faster, more precise, and less dependent on mass. Precision-guided munitions, stealth, network sensors, and advanced communications promised a level of battlefield awareness that earlier generations could scarcely imagine. Yet the war in Ukraine presents a more complicated picture. Today, infantry soldiers can spend months underground avoiding sunlight and limiting movement just to evade drone detection. Resupply often arrives by unmanned aircraft. Casualty evacuation depends on ground robots. Because surveillance is so persistent, even small concentrations of troops attract immediate, lethal precision strikes. The modern battlefield has become hyper-transparent and increasingly deadly. At the same time, this conflict has reaffirmed some enduring realities. Territory still matters. Land forces must still hold and defend ground, and campaigns remain central to achieving political objectives. Despite the proliferation of high-tech gear, wars are ultimately fought by human beings who must endure extraordinary physical and psychological demands. These developments raise important questions. Are we witnessing a truly revolution in military affairs? Have drones, artificial intelligence, and affordable precision fundamentally changed how wars are fought and won? Or are these technologies simply altering the character of war while leaving its underlying nature unchanged? In this episode of Strategic Voices, we explore the changing character of war and examine how emerging technologies are transforming the battlefield, military doctrine, and the future of conflict. Join with me today to unpack this is my colleague, Professor Andrea Mulgee. Let's begin.
Oh my goodness, can you believe it? We are in Brunei. I said we were going to take it on the road, and here we are. What do you think, Andrea? You been out on the streets at all?
I've been out enjoying Brunei. It's a beautiful country, lots of lovely people, had some very delicious food. Been searching for the elusive proboscis monkey, just joining us here, by the way.
So you told me about this monkey, and so say more. What makes you interested in this particular one?
It is only found in Borneo, so it is unique, indigenous to this area, and so it's something you won't see in the rest of the world, and so I was hoping to see it. I haven't found one yet.
We can leave you here until that sighting occurs?
Thinking about it.
Okay. Does this one have a name?
That's Eugene.
Eugene. Yeah. We're going to leave Eugene here in the show with us? Is that okay?
He's going to sit there, supervise.
We're good with that. Craig, you know, I should probably tell the group, Lieutenant Colonel Craig Painter out at the center, he has been out there about a year, right? Mm-hmm. You came to us as an Army fellow, mm-hmm. and I'm so glad that you're able to come out here to Brunei with us. We're out here for the Indo-Pacific Senior Enlisted Leaders Subject Matter Expert Exchange, IPSLS Meet, third iteration, first time in region. Mm-hmm. We have about 100 fellows plus a whole lot of others. This is amazing. Thank you for being here. How's it been so far for you?
Oh, it's been great. And I want to give my thank you to you as well for bringing me on and even being a player at the last minute. So it's always exciting to get out to different regions. And Brunei, wow, Brunei, I never even thought that I'd have the opportunity to come here. Also, scavenge for the elusive monkey is very exciting. And just being a part of the group and then able to talk a little bit more in discussion with the character of war here.
Man, this is fascinating. You know, when I was, when we talked about coming out here, talking about the character of war, and I was getting ready to get on the plane, getting all my stuff together, I said to myself, what book shall I take? Because, of course, I brought more than one, but I said, I got to bring Christian Brose's book. I've read it before. It's The Kill Chain. Came out in 2020. You know, he's a former staff director for the Armed Services Committee. Oh my goodness, this is an amazing book. And so I don't often read books twice, but he talks about technology and how it is changing this character of war that we're going to talk about, and that it, we're going to find ourselves in this mesh type of networking, where sensors and platforms are clearly engaging, irrespective of a single kill chain, irrespective of just one sensor talking to one platform. But you need something, and it pops up, and it does it. Obviously, there's more to this, but the distribution of platforms is drastically going to change. We'll talk more on this, but the fantastic book. But I know I asked you to read a couple other things. This was some fascinating reading. I went through these twice. So maybe I just might remind. So the first one is called The New Revolution in Military Affairs. And it's by Andriy Zagorodnyuk. And he is former defense minister in Ukraine. Revolution in Military Affairs. Now that sounds like, without understanding it, it'd be like, cool words, what does it mean? We're going to talk on, we ought to, you know, unpack that a second. And so when we think about this revolution in military affairs, this is, I know it's not going to sound like a new term, but it's a fairly new term. It was termed around 1991 or so by Andrew Marshall. And Andrew Marshall was the director of the What was the center? It was the Office of Net Assessment. That's right. And so he came in early. He came in 1973 and held that position up until, I think, 2015. And you ask yourself, why did he come up with this term? It's because we're trying to understand this change that was taking place. I was a Cold Warrior, fought before this 1991 period. I'd been in the Army for 10 years. Already, we were fighting a different way. Maybe we'll talk about that. But in 1990-91, Gulf War began. You had Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, Desert Shield begins. As it were, Saddam Hussein crosses the border into Kuwait on the 2nd of August of 1990. We will spend months, 6 months probably, building up combat forces, and eventually early, probably I think it was February of 91, we conduct operations which had not been seen to that point. Precision guided munitions. The use of GPS in the United States was tremendously and violently successful. We had changed the character of war. We'll talk more on that. But this, and so when he talks about this revolution in military affairs, we're really talking about changes in operating concepts, how we see that we will fight, and doctrine. So it's not enough just to have technology, because if you have technology but you don't know how to use it, it's not changing the way you've done it, or you haven't changed your tactics and doctrine to do it differently. And so that's where he pulls on. You can say more, but I'll stop there on that. And then the other one is by Amos Fox, and Amos is a professor of practice out in Arizona University. Fantastic piece here. Winning in the Donbass, what Russia's 2014-15 campaign reveals about modern war. And I foot stomp on this modern war piece because we find ourselves a bit talking about this. I think if I were going to pull just a second more on this Ipsil-SME going on, we were downstairs and somebody asked a fantastic question. How are we preparing people enlisted and senior enlisted for this modern war? Not just combat that maybe we experienced over 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the type of thing that's happening now. Love the answers that were given, but this modern war is kind of what we want to pull on a bit here. I said a mouthful. I'll pause for a second. Thoughts on any of these things?
Well, I think the main thing here is our adaptability to change. There are some things that resonate from previous wars, and I think I've mentioned in our discussions and talk about if history doesn't repeat itself, it rings. So there are...
It's got this rhyme, this rhythm going through, this ring.
And there are things that are consistent through time, but there's different external or internal factors that change. One thing that you mentioned about, like, technology. So we're in the evolution of technology and talking about drones and AI and so forth. And the other thing is the doctrine piece and how those match up. Because if we have the tools, but if we're not practicing the right craft with the tools, we could be misaligned and there could be missteps along the way. And we're seeing, and I know we've read and hinted on that a lot with the Ukraine and Russian conflict. With that, with what's been going on for the last 4 years, and taking the lessons learned from that, even in the development of technology with masks and with drones, it's fascinating to see, but it's also completely frightening as well. Just thinking back, if that layer was there in my time in Iraq and Afghanistan, and how significant would that have changed our position and the way we fought those conflicts at that time?
Yeah, no, we're going to unpack all that. I mean, that's the stuff that Andrea pulls out in his article. And so thanks for highlighting that. Andrea.
Yeah, I mean, Craig's totally right. It's all about adaptability. You can have the most expensive high-tech systems in the world, but if you are not adapting and you're still living in, you know, the scenes from 10 years ago, then you're not guaranteed a victory. So how are you adapting, not just, you know, by the year, but sometimes we're looking at, you know, by the week, by the day, especially as we involve AI and all of the use of drones in modern warfare and what that looks at like. So just having the access to, you know, certain weapons, it's not guaranteed success anymore. So how are you going to adapt?
You know, it's the adaptability, both of you mentioned it. Years ago, and this is a few years ago, and I'm not necessarily a Star Trek-y, but I have watched several episodes. And while I didn't watch the one I'm about to mention the first time, I don't remember watching it. I saw it in the 70s in a rerun. But in 1967, season 1, episode 23, literally this episode has rung in my head for decades now. Why? It was called A Taste of Armageddon. And so what happens is, obviously, James Kirk and all his and the Enterprise show up. These two worlds have been fighting each other for 500 years. But they have stopped fighting on a battlefield. They no longer wanted to have infrastructure being destroyed. And so it was a computer-based game. And I saw it in the early 70s. It came out in 67. Computers were not that big of a thing. It was a computer-based game. And if you took casualties and loss, the other side guaranteed that within 24 hours they would line up that number of civilians to go into the extermination machine and they would die. So it had clearly... So I asked myself over time, are we talking about a change... In this example, are we talking about a change of nature? Or are we talking about a change of character? Now, I do think it is a change of character of war, not a change of nature. And why is that? Well, I mean, Karl von Clausewitz, you know, we pull on him all the time, at least Westerners do. And his, you know, principal treatise on war, he talks about this nature and character. And he says the nature of war is enduring. And so why so? He talks about because it's always has a political element. It always... is violent, is unpredictable. It is the level of destruction and the human involvement, these things don't change. And so I asked myself as I looked at this, was that true in that case? And it was. The character had vastly changed from what I thought about conflict. This was obviously portended into the future. But here we are, and we've watched this changing character of war so many times. And it causes militaries to do differently or suffer from their inability or failure to do that. So I kind of thought, as I was thinking about those things, I'm ready to pull a little bit on some of these things that came up in the article. But anything before that?
Yeah, I mean, pulling up on the, you know, I think that's actually a great reference to the Star Trek episode, because at the end of the day, fought completely different, character was different, but the people died.
It did.
The people still died. It was violent. It had a human element. And it was about some sort of political conflict. So if we look at what are the most recent conflicts that are happening in the world, has the character, has the way that it's being fought, whether it's drones, whether it's AI, that character, we see that in Ukraine. We see that that's changed. You know, India and Pakistan, which I'll pull up on a little bit later. Also, it's about territory. That's inherently political. That's what all of the wars since the origins of those two countries in 1947, that's what the conflict has been about, was territory. But the way in which they are fighting this war, that character is different. But that political element, the nature of it, is still the same.
Yeah. No, fair. Craig?
When you talk about that episode, and we discussed a little bit last night, I thought, are we in a transition from like science fiction to science fact? Like, are things happening that you know, were put on the screen and somebody dreamed about and played out, and you're like, oh, that's really weird. And then now, on a reflection years later, you look back and the parallels are starting to collide together. Another thing I look at is the logistics angle with this. And with the new character war and the demands of the hyper-responsive supply chains, and just the amount of change that is happening consistently and constantly is fascinating. And another thing is how do we solve this problem collectively as a whole and sustain?
Yeah, sometimes I often think problems aren't solvable, maybe manageable, maybe adaptable. You've both mentioned that, but I wholly agree that we must respond, we must change. And I want maybe we just pull on some of that as we go through this. And so Andrei Zagorodnyuk, he mentioned several things. And so as we look at some of these, he talks about this transparent battlefield. And so I thought about that, and I said, is this different? And in some regards, it clearly is. We have had this thing for many years, this COP, this common operating picture, where we have tried to see the battlefield and then distribute that throughout the force so that they could see it. I played's probably a good term. This must have been in the mid-90s, early 90s. It was the early 90s. I was at Fort Bragg, Fort Campbell, and General Petraeus, a name that people know, he was a lieutenant colonel at the time. He was a battalion commander. I was a fire support officer and one of the companies. And bottom line is, we were down at National JRTC, Joint Readiness Training Center, playing the Op 4. The reason I remember this all these years is because I never felt more vulnerable at a period of time. Because even in those years, and it was fairly, it was just after the Gulf War, still the U.S. air helicopters in the air. I knew they were there. I could know that they could, by heat senses, pick us up. I knew this was going to mean, after they detected us, that they were going to, call in fire on us. Anyhow, a lot of fun things from that from that operation, that exercise. But it made you think. While the United States has benefited from a lot of this common operating picture we're speaking about and having transparency, that doesn't necessarily that didn't resonate for all the those on the battlefield. So. Recently we had in the center, and even on the Dialogue podcast that I do, I had Katrina Bonder on, and she spoke about, we did drones and AI at war, and she spoke about the Ukrainian system, Delta, but I think you too also may have, in a lecture she did, speaking about this Delta system that the Ukrainians are using that are trying to do this and integrate all of these things together. And it made me also think about our own developments in the Maven smart systems. And when I look at these things, and you'll recall, I know, Andrea, that I brought that up, Katrina Manson's book a little bit ago, that I said I was going to get that book and read it. It is less about being able to see these things. It is how do we connect them so that they are all responding. In the past, it's been, I got it over here on this system, and it's over here on this system, and I have to move it over. That is all time intensive. That is yesteryear. That is not the direction we're going. It's not what I spoke about, the kill chain and really creating this kill web. Mm-hmm. And this drastically creates a different environment where we can see thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, the first one with the common operating picture, and then my mind kind of goes into service specific and then looking joint, right, within the U.S. military. But that's one thing that we interconnected and communicate well. But I think the key thing is with our allies and partners, especially in the region.
Oh, that's the harder part, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's hard enough to do. No, you keep it going. It's hard enough to go joint, but you add allies and partners in there. Significantly harder.
And even through just experience and exercises and reading up on different articles in AARs, one of our most significant shortfalls right now that we're trying to overcome is that, you know, we talk about this emerging technology, but it's also collectively for us to communicate with each other. Or we might have similar type of systems in regards to communication, but they're made in different places. They have different maintenance. They have different cryptological requirements. So they have a thing that they can use for a purpose, but they're not interconnected where we can communicate. And then you have to find out the slower ways, like the pigeon. Do I write you the note and hand it over to you to communicate something that we might need to make a decision on, like in seconds and not minutes or hours or weeks or months?
So this Joint All Domain Command and Control, JADC, the combined piece. But the piece I want to mention is presently, what you just said is you've got defense primes that are creating a platform and they have the proprietary information in it. And so the challenge is to get the whole system working. And so if you pull out, if we pulled out our smartphones or something, you say there's nothing special about the device. Throw the device away, grab another one off the store, all your stuff comes back, it can communicate on the system. It doesn't matter. You could be a Samsung, it could be a iPhone, it could be any other, Nokia, it could be any company. It's going to work on the system. But we can't do that in defense systems.
Well, you talk about like the intellectual property.
Yeah.
That piece right there, and it's, you know, right now I went to the Defense Department of War made its symposium in Phoenix, and these were topics that they were talking about. One is cutting through the bureaucracy and red tape that we have internally, working stronger with allies and partners to bridge that gap, and then getting the stuff that we need in time of need versus it having to go back to a depot or it having to go back to the manufacturer that could be thousands of miles away, the tyranny of distance that we talk about in the Pacific, and the time of need. Because the time of need in conflict or crisis is now, not tomorrow, not in a month, it is now.
See, the prisoner is not. I want to pull on two things you said, and I know Andrea's done some work on Mars. And you ask yourself, why can't we do what you just said? So you said, oh, you know, we ought to, you know, work. Here's why. It's because we need to have a standard. If this is the standard to communicate on the system, all companies would have to achieve that standard. That's why it works on your civilian mobile phones and stuff, is because nobody's going to make something that doesn't meet the technical standard because it won't work on the system. But that's not the way we do the defense, and hence we're more challenged there. But if the Department of War said it'll be on this standard or it won't be, companies would figure out how to start working on that single standard. Now, you've been working on the multi-armaments resilience seminar, Mars, right?
Yes.
And so you must have, because part of it, I don't know, have you had any work on, we were talking about going back to the depots and all this other things. I was thinking about Ukraine and how they are printing in the field all these different systems and components and modifications to drones and stuff. You must have worked some of this or been thinking about it.
Yeah, I've been able to do some site surveys where we were able to see firsthand some of the both the old ways, like in an armaments facility, the old school way of putting together weapons, but also what's on the cutting edge of what's happening, especially with additive manufacturing and 3D printing. And so one of the places that I was able to see most recently in Australia was showing us how they had created a 3D printer that was portable into the field. And so whatever part that they needed to make, they could make it on the spot, often within 10 minutes, from copper, from titanium. Rather than, you know, waiting days, weeks, months, to get a replacement part, they could have it right there on the field. And so we were just looking at, you know, parts of like a machine that could be needed. But the way that it speeds up the amount of time compared to what it was in the past was just transformational and how portable it was.
Until, I don't know, a year or so ago, my son Wayne, he showed me, he has a 3D printer. Now, it doesn't have the components of brass and titanium and these things, whatever the filament is, it's different. But the concept is what you're talking about. And having seen it, it feels less foreign. But at the time, I was like, huh, if you make a thing and it needs a hinge, how does that work? I asked him, how does that work? He said, I don't know. It actually printed the hinge within it that it would work. It didn't have to be assembled. It did the thing. Just absolutely fascinating when you talk about this and you think about this. And Ukraine is doing this. We got so much to learn in what's happening there.
Yeah, and we do. And I think we really have to take a hard look at kind of talking about what you were mentioning earlier, Dr. Minnick, was the change in doctrine.
Yeah.
I think that's significant, right? Because if we're going off doctrine that was written a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and the technological change that we're seeing in the field, we have to, like, it's an absolute must to ensure our success with the United States and as well as with our allies and partners.
So when you say doctrine, immediately my mind was running to MDO, multi-domain operations. Mm. And we ask ourselves, with this new doctrine, why, what's different? So in 1986, you get the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which forces us to be joint. Because what happens in 83, in October of 83, you've got Grenada. And Schwarzkopf wrote a fantastic book, talked about the Army, he was on the ships, and the Navy just wouldn't work with them. It was just really terrible. Okay, you pull all these lessons. 86 said, we got to do better. You got to have joint. But joint is really helping us work through these, coordinate amongst the services. Multi-domain operation is asking us to bring all of these capabilities. And Craig, you spoke about some of this the other day, but you're talking about the land, sea, air, space, cyberspace, and work all of this concurrently. It's perhaps in some regards a little more aspirational than where we're at, but it is to understand how we operate in all this space. You talked about doctrine. That my mind goes there.
Yeah, and then one of the other things, just hot off the press, I believe it was yesterday or earlier this morning, was so the United States Army established a space branch. It goes back to, it goes back to adaptability and change. And you know, most recently with cyberspace and space operations, Space Force was established in the last 10 years. And there's a significant amount of focus
in the 2027 National Defense Authorization Act that Senate put forward. They had, of course, it hasn't been passed yet. It's not in a bill yet, but they put forward suggesting that they should create a new combatant command. Last combatant command that had been established, I guess, was 2019 Space Command. Mm. And so this would be a, these are combatant commands or warfighters, and so they're not service providers. And so it would probably, because it would have, and so what does it do? So what was the command? It was robotic and autonomous systems combatant command, I think it was the suggested title. But it gets after what it's doing, and the thing that it's doing is trying to be in the leading edge of using those capabilities. And then you would think, or at least I do, this maybe seems more like a special operations command, a SOCOM, that has it can, you know, send forces down into, because geographical combatant commands, they own the geography of the world and they operate within it, but they would also have their own acquisition authorities and stuff to be able to get these things, which regular combatant commands do not have. But anyway, you're talking about changing all of these things like this, creating these different ones, and there is a lot of effort in that area to ask ourselves, how can we become more responsive in this area? As you just look around, you can see all of what you're talking about. Affordability and precision mass was the next one. Mm. The precision mass, when we think about precision guided munitions, PGMs, this really became big in the Gulf War. But what's the difference? Well, the difference is the United States had all of this stuff, and it cost a lot of money, but we still had all of this stuff. We kind of had the lock on it, and we have now seen that that's not the case. It's affordable, it's cheap. You were talking with me just a little bit yesterday, I think, about some of that. What were you?
Yeah, additionally, when I was doing some of the site surveys for our Mars course, I was able to see some of this rapidly changing tech, but also it was surprisingly simplistic as well with the drones that are being manufactured and being sent to Ukraine. You could get several of them for under $30,000, and you could just get the shipment for them. And so seeing, and you look at it, and it looks like something, you know, it's cardboard, essentially. But it's able to operate in different environments and the capabilities. And so when I would have just taken a first glance at it, I would have thought, this can't do very much. But they're being ordered on a very grand scale because of what they are capable of doing, but because they're also very cheap. And so everybody wants them, and especially they want them in Ukraine as well. So being able to, you know, go see the 3D printer, the additive manufacturing, but also see, you know, these drones that are changing, you know, the way that the war is being fought over in Ukraine, it was really eye-opening for me.
When you talk about that, Andrew, it makes me now think about this fragmented air domain. We used to think in terms of the United States had air supremacy over an area. We could operate with impunity. Yep. Once we had that, drop bombs where we want, do what we want, and that's not the case anymore because it's fragmented. Right. You may own a segment of it. You may have the high altitude where you've got ISR capabilities and can do nothing about the low altitude where a plethora of these lighter drones and stuff are operating that are very precise in their things.
It's, exactly. Yeah. Like control of the high altitude, it's not going to guarantee the safety from drone swarms anymore. So it's just not the case. And so that's part of this changing character.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing that comes to mind before we move on with the fragmented airspace is Chinese development. And so they've developed the mother of all drones. And so that's a drone platform that can deliver several hundred drones I can't remember the time and distance away it can go. But those are some technology developments that, and that was as of last year that came out. I think it was around March, April of last year.
They use a lot of drones in Ukraine right now, but drone warfare is going to evolve. Why do I say that? It's because the introduction of swarming drones, the ability to, they can communicate internally without external communications. When you create that to the degree that the electronic warfare, EW, is no longer effective at jamming communications because they're not communicating, then you ask yourself, how do you stop the thing? We're stopping quite a few. I mean, they are being stopped on both sides because of EW capabilities. But, you know, Russia has been testing swarm warfare in Ukraine. Katerina Bondra was telling me about how when they looked at the residues of these that had fallen, they realized that they weren't communicating out, but they were able to determine their own, you know, their positioning within the flock. Some of it was visual, mostly visual, whether it was with markings on wings or lights or different things. But the larger point being, if something happened to one of the birds, the next one just came in and took it. And they would go in there and they would adjust and fly and they would find their target. Go find a target in this direction. They would go find it and then they would circle around it. First one in. Next one determining where it needed to go in and in and in and in until they destroyed the thing. And so that was with, you know, relatively, you know, what are small numbers, 10, 15, 20, but hundreds, when we get to that, and we will get to that, this is a whole different way of trying to think how to counter these things. This is a direct, and so I think I'd make this one note, and that was that if we think about the force today, we think about a small enough number of platforms. The Navy has 260 ships or whatever, right? And a number of aircraft. And I don't know, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers to make that all work. What happens, and we will get there, when one or a very few number of soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, now operate many platforms, meaning that the platform, it flips, rather than a whole lot of people coordinating one platform, it is very few people coordinating many platforms. That's going to change.
So, just Dr. Minnick, something that comes to mind, especially as an Army logistician, there's a lot of things to plan for. And how has that changed, especially with the movement of logistics and sustaining the force? So, 2027 comes to mind. And another thing is how to prepare for large-scale combat operations. Because there's been a significant change in focus that I've seen from the Army side of where we went to asymmetrical warfare, FOBs, already pre-established for years of logistical nodes. So very easy to maneuver operations, handling out of a secured area that was not really affected by what is happening today. And that's what I mentioned before, like how significant a change that would be. But the biggest thing for me in preparation is like, how does that change our planning? How does that change in regards to the assets and time and movement? And maybe it gives us more opportunity and less constraints, or potentially, depending on the technology and what we have available and the cost, it could be a constraint significantly, or with our allies and partners that would be working with us in potential LISCO environment.
Andrea, thoughts?
Yeah, I actually would like to pull on India-Pakistan here because I think it can relate to what we're talking about.
We're talking about the war from last year?
Yes. So if we're talking about the future of what warfare and the use of drones looks like, we generally like to talk about Russia and Ukraine, which of course is very instructive. But when we look at India-Pakistan, we can also get a lot of new lessons about kind of the future of how there's going to be a combination of both like these inexpensive mass precision strike capabilities, but also more traditional warfare as well. So to get to the original question of like the character versus the nature, you know, it was political. It was, again, about Kashmir, which is what India and Pakistan have fought over for decades. All of their wars have been essentially over this issue. But what now that we saw different was the response. And learning also through this what the capabilities of the other was and what their appetite is. And so both sides used very cheap reconnaissance drones. That was part of it. But we also have, you know, $2,000 drones carrying out precision strikes. But the drones making it unsafe for these very expensive fighter jets to even be in the sky. Mm-hmm. So you have something that's, you know, $2,000, $20,000, that's making it too dangerous for an $80 million jet to be in that airspace because of the use of not just the reconnaissance drones, but also a new reliance on what were called the kamikaze drones that were used on both sides, which were loitering munitions. And so being able to see how that had adapted from the previous ways that we'd seen conflict in India-Pakistan, again, we see the same nature of it, but the way that it was being fought with the use of all of the drones in addition to the cyber domain. So this was a multi-domain conflict. But we're seeing not just jamming, GPS jamming operations, there's cyber attacks that are happening on the grids. But in addition to that, something that we haven't talked about yet was the use of social media and misinformation and deep fakes and how that was impacting sort of the will to fight. Is that people are looking on social media and seeing imagery that is made up, but thinking that that's accurate. And how, when we're talking about now the decision times coming down to minutes, to seconds, when that is also, we have this new element that's coming into play, it changes the overall way that the war is being fought, the character.
Yeah. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about military elements of this changing character of war. You brought up several of them, but one of them you just brought up the social element of this, and the use of social media or the use of fake videos or things. How do you affect the will to fight in a non-kinetic means is what you're describing, and that is definitely a changing character, and we are seeing it there in so many other places. It is fascinating. It also sounded like you were describing this, non-contact conflict that was going on, sending things but not people.
That's right. And at the end of the day, besides the initial terrorist attack that started, that triggered this conflict, there wasn't, as far as we know, some of it's still unknown, but there wasn't a loss of life. There weren't casualties. Mm-hmm. That happened after this. This was almost entirely done in the air and cyber domain. And so that's not been the case with Russia and Ukraine, but it was the case with India and Pakistan, is that there was no direct confrontation between soldiers. There weren't dogfights.
Yeah. Something I was thinking of, and kind of goes back into recent historical context with the development of, I know we kind of highlighted a lot with the drones and how that's changing the character of war and how we're reacting to it. But one of the things that is a quick reflection and looking at is in the theater of Iraq and Afghanistan with the IEDs and EFPs. Mm. These are very simple, cheap, easy. You go from pressure plates, you go from the RFID, where they can just hit it and go. You got the direct line, and didn't take a lot of time, didn't take a lot of effort or expertise to do it. And you had several hundred thousand dollars, million dollars equipment rolling down, either with combat patrols or logistical convoys that are being disrupted by something cheap and easy that you can just throw on the ground and go. And now we have the en masse, or how easy it is to maneuver these drones and to disrupt, even from far away.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I can't remember, so correct me. Did we bring up, I wanted to talk about Hedgehog 2025. Did we bring that up in this, or were we talking about this offline?
Danced around it, but not specifically.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
So the reason I say that is because you talked about how we had to change tactics. So I was a field grade officer when 9/11 happened. We were doing all kinds of other types of conflict. This was not what we were doing. Mm-hmm. You say we get off, and you were there. I know you were in Iraq and Afghanistan. We got off there, and bottom line is we realized we had to do things differently because of these cheap IEDs that were killing service members over there, and we had to have different capabilities. And so that's now, of course, we're finding the ability to maneuver is a very difficult thing on the battlefield right now. In Ukraine, the human dimension of this, they are underground, maybe for some long periods of time, had that experience twice working in underground bunkers in my career. But these are months and months at a time. 45 days, I think, was my longest time. These are much longer. And how that is affecting morale and stuff. But it is also, they're doing this because they can't maneuver on the battlefield. They're being destroyed. And so in Hedgehog 2025, a NATO exercise that takes place, they look at, they use the Ukrainians as the op for, and against the NATO combined exercise. And so in a typical large maneuver exercise we think about, you kind of go into the assembly area and then you kind of unroll out of the assembly area into combat formations and you do the thing. Ukrainians destroyed them in the assembly area before they had a chance to deploy in combat formations. And one of the lessons learned from that was we have got to do things differently. And so fortunately, these are exercises now, but we are maybe slowly, but we are recognizing there is so much changing that we have to adapt and modify, our operating concepts and our doctrines and stuff. Maybe because I know we could probably take this another hour, but I know we're going to have to not do that. Maybe the last piece we hit here is human dimension. When we were when we were talking with the group today, Ipsil Sami, there was a great question. It asked about how we're getting after this human dimension element. And so I just mentioned a little bit, it is changing a lot in combat in Ukraine and Russia because of the massive toll. I mean, they're going to war and they're at war until, maybe a little bit of reprieve off the line, but there's just nowhere to go. And so it is having a massive toll. But when we think about fighting a war with significant casualty loss, we haven't fought one of those kind of wars. The Americans haven't fought one of those kind of wars really since the Second World War. And so the question rightly asked was, how are we preparing for that? And so how did that strike you? When I thought that was a pretty powerful question that was asked. Did that strike you at all when you were listening?
Yeah, I mean, so there's realities of what's happening, right, versus hypothetical or previous to the Ukraine-Russia conflict. We could reflect and we could look on Vietnam, World War II, World War I in historical context, but not really taking it and seeing it in life where it's happening right now. And so for us, I don't think there's an appetite for that significant amount of loss for the United States or for any of our allies and partners in with that. And I think also what resonates for me specifically, it goes back to that adaptability. How are we adapting? How are we changing? How are we transforming now? And a piece of that is putting the people in place where it needs to be. We talked about posturing. I know it's getting a little off, but we talked about posturing in the region, and then as well is constant presence in the region as well. So I think what our focus in that piece is where we put our time and attention, and adaptability, reduction or reduce the risk of mitigation of life loss or casualties and death. And I think most importantly is deterrence.
Yeah. I mentioned that very fortunately in this most recent conflict in India and Pakistan, after the terrorist attack, there was no loss of life that we know of. And that's very fortunate. But the underlying conflict was not resolved here. And so it's just a matter of time until the next conflict happens. And these are two nuclear-armed countries. And so when you have two nuclear-armed countries going head-to-head in a conflict, then the potential for mass casualties is high, especially if there is an increasing appetite to engage with one another and even potentially, use those weapons. We looked up the casualties that have happened in Russia and Ukraine. And I was surprised. I didn't realize it was as high as it was to see that it's hundreds of thousands and some estimates even over a million. And so to see that level of loss, I think, does give us some indication of where things could be. And this is just, two countries, right? Yeah. But bringing it back again to India and Pakistan and what the potential is. You know, we've been lucky that it's not been, but the risk is where does it go in the future, and how do we do everything to mitigate the potential for that happening? Back to Craig's point.
Yeah, months ago we on a different episode we spoke about the security environment through disruption, division, competition, and it makes me in this competitive multipolarity, and we spoke that very well, and it creates a very dangerous environment that we're in, which is more so than bilateral. You know, I'd love to talk to you on this more. Let's switch though to our wins and woes that we like to go to. And so, you got us a win for.
Surprise! I'm going to talk about critical minerals.
Oh
yeah,
my. I was excited about that.
Okay, so there's been a lot. There's been a lot of initiatives with ministerials and critical minerals developments in the last several months. The U.S. has really taken initiative on that, and so there was a new critical minerals initiative that was announced for the Quad. So that is something new. You know, we hadn't seen some of the engagement that maybe we would like to see with the Quad recently. So for me, this was a very exciting update. $20 billion to help mobilize mining, especially processing, because most of this is the missing midstream is what it's called. Mm. Most of that's happening, the processing of these critical minerals, it's happening in China. Mm. And so that's a major shortfall of the rest of the world. So how can the quads, especially like Australia, India, the U.S., work together to help kind of counter and diversify supply chains and helping do this processing elsewhere? And then you have, you know, countries like Australia, which have large amounts of lithium and cobalt and rare earths, and so being able to better friendshore, which Australia has already been working on that for the last 3 years or so, but to see it now through the Quad framework, I think is a really positive development, especially as relationships with India go. It helping to bring them in as well as how they might play a role in that midstream processing.
Oh, fantastic.
I'm happy about it.
Okay, let's go, Craig.
Well, I got 2 points, both coming from the Philippines. The first one is the win is the utilization of drone boats for the United States Army when they are escorting their Army Logistics Support Vessel, LSV, if you're familiar with that. And then that was just a couple months ago during the Philippine Salakanib exercise. And my second point, and it was just part of it was just kind of learning and reflecting. So with the Philippines, they have over 500,000 mariners, and you're looking at 7,000 islands. So that's a fact, right?
Yeah.
But the way they're doing logistics, and so the thing that I want to take as a win, and also probably take it as a case study and learn, especially when we talk about large-scale combat operations and other things that we talked about, even just with the drone boat utilization for security for the LSV to the port, was the asymmetric archipelagic logistics. So instead of having everything on one big boat and to move it from port to port, they have several small wooden boats that they're utilizing to maneuver logistics around quickly and fast. And if you think of the point going back to conflict or crisis, that will be an essential piece, if needed, to move those logistics. And I would even garner at that point their potential with more of the drone boat utilization or even subs to move stuff around.
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating. My quick win, over decades, we have tried to get Southeast Asia to diversify its arms procurement, about 20%. So if you look at 2017 to about 2021, 20% of their arms procurement here came from Russia. Well, after 22 to 2024, after the invasion of Ukraine, that has dropped down to below 3%. So what we couldn't achieve before this conflict, the conflict has brought it about. And out of the top three, China, Russia, and the United States, and I already said that Russia is a very small percentage, it's about 15% of the totality. And then it's really mostly the other 85% is a lot of U.S. allies and partners that are selling, whether it's France, South Korea, Turkey, these countries. And so significant change. Whoa.
Well, Surprise, it's going to be in the South China Sea. So there has been recently more rapid construction of a new artificial island at Antelope Reef. This is not new, but the pace and scale with which it's been done is following a lull of like 8 years into now that the this new island reclamation project is it's as 1,490 acres, which is almost as large as the largest artificial island in Mischief Reef. Yeah. So what we're also now seeing is, you know, from December into May, we are from December to May, we've seen this massive island that now also includes a new runway as well. Nice. But Vietnam is also responding. So Vietnam is also responding by building its own major island in the area as well. And Vietnam has not really historically responded, even though it claims the Paracel Islands.
Watch the spaces, they say, yeah?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Craig, quickly.
So there was an incident in March of this year with a Chinese missile frigate. They executed a near collision cutoff of a Philippine ship off the Pegasa Island. And then this is weeks after the warship painted a Philippine ship with a fire control radar. So concern here is there's no real-time maritime electronic threat sharing network. I think we talked about that, things like that earlier versus the kill chain versus the web. So that would link the Philippines with neighbors like Malaysia, Vietnam, and Indonesia. So that is something of concern.
Okay. Well, let me give you my one concern. Yesterday was the anniversary of the Korean War, UEO, June 25th. North Koreans had, under the supervision of their leader, Kim Jong-un, oversaw a testing of a new close-range ballistic missile capability intended to be able to use nuclear strikes in South Korea on infrastructure and critical ports and stuff. You don't produce that type of capability just to say you have nuclear capability. You produce that capability because you intend to have doctrine and concepts to engage it, employ it, which they do. It is deeply troubling. Oh my goodness. It feels like it was long coming. So glad to be here in Brunei, sitting down, not just for Ipsil-SME, but our first in-region episode of Strategic Voices. Thanks for being here, Craig. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Andrea, as always.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. From us, we'll take care. From all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining Strategic Voices. While emerging tech continues to accelerate the tempo and transparency of the modern battlefield, the ultimate resolution of conflict remains, as it always has been, a deeply human endeavor. We hope you'll join us again for the next episode of Strategic Voices. For Professor Andrea Malji, I'm James Minnick. Until we meet again, aloha. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.